Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, as the pandemic continues to ravage the country, will the San Joaquin Valley see a fall surge? Plus, we delve into Tuesday's election results. But first, let's turn to the pandemic. In the small farming town of Mendota, Latinx-owned small businesses have struggled to stay afloat and receive federal aid. FM89's Madi Bolaños talks to two restaurant owners about the challenges they've faced.
The TV station Univision plays in the background at Las Morenitas, a small Salvadorian restaurant on the town's main street. Maria Morena has owned the place with her husband Francisco for 12 years. Right now, she's taking a break after frying pupusas for a few lunch customers.
We aren't making any profits. We're just paying the bills. And well, we have no employees except for the family that has to step up to help us out.
Maria and Francisco's three adult children all pitch in with the day-to-day operations at the restaurant. Morena says it's been a struggle, but at least it's better than it was at the beginning of the pandemic.
There were 3 months that we were only doing takeout. March, April, May, and of course that meant that we were making far less than we will have if we were able to open fully.
In June, one of her children went online and applied for a small business loan grant.
They're still telling us that they will let us know, but we have not heard from them. They said that it will take 3 to 6 months, but here we are, still waiting.
Still waiting with their savings already emptied. And even after beginning to open with some restrictions due to COVID-19, Morena says she's uncertain about the future of Las Morenitas.
We open, but if they say there are more cases, then we have to close again. So we are nervously waiting it out.
Yvette Salas with Camino Financial, an online small business lender, says Morena's situation isn't unique. Camino Financial released a survey in October that showed many Latinx-owned businesses struggled to receive government aid. And
because of lack of securing funds, relief funds during the pandemic, a lot of these small businesses had to go into the reserve accounts and had to carry over those losses.
And the survey found many Latinx small business owners were hesitant to reach out to organizations like the Better Business Bureau or a bank.
They're not plugged into the mainstream financing. So a lot of times they don't have a relationship with their bank.
But at another Salvadorian restaurant in Mendota, Antojitos Huanacos, the owner was able to take out a loan. Miguel Urias says he had depleted his savings trying to keep his restaurant going when he saw an ad on TV from the Better Business Bureau offering small business loans.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I closed the restaurant for 2 weeks, and I was thinking about closing completely because we weren't making anything. We didn't have any money to pay for the bills.
The family has owned the restaurant for 20 years, and Uria says the pandemic has been catastrophic for his business.
At the beginning of the pandemic, I closed the restaurant for 2 weeks. And I was thinking about closing completely because we weren't making anything. We didn't have any money to pay the bills.
He says being able to open at 25% capacity has helped, but now it's down to him and one other employee running the restaurant.
One of the employees left because she didn't want to work for just 2 hours and run the risk of catching COVID.
And that's another challenge these restaurants face, keeping customers and employees safe from the virus. At Las Morenitas, Morena says they try to follow the CDC guidelines as best they can.
In the kitchen, we wear masks, and the customers are in charge of protecting themselves and others with a mask.
But some customers refuse to wear them, like 52-year-old Juan Ruiz, who's a regular at Las Morenitas. He's sitting at a table drinking a beer while waiting for his food. When he finishes his meal, he won't put on a mask.
For me, that doesn't help at all. At all. As humans, we all have rights.
He says his sister contracted COVID earlier this year, even though she wore a mask. And in spite of the fact that public health experts say masks do reduce the spread of COVID-19, Ruiz thinks the government should suspend their use.
No va a pasar nada.
Nothing is going to happen. As humans, we've ingrained into our minds that if we don't wear the mask, we're going to get the sickness. No.
In addition to asking her customers to follow safe practices, Morena has also created an outdoor sitting area for those who feel safer eating outside. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's been a long election season, and there was a lot on the ballot beyond the presidential race. To talk about how California voters decided some key issues and how political divisiveness is affecting our local politics, I spoke with Jim Boren, Executive Director of the Institute for Media and Public Trust at Fresno State, Amanda Renteria, CEO of Code for America, and Clint Olivier, former Fresno City Council member and Executive Director of the Business Federation of the Central Valley.
So at the time we're having this conversation, the presidential race remains undecided. But one thing that we do know for sure is that America is deeply divided. Amanda Renteria, you know something about this. In 2016, you worked as the National Political Director for Hillary Clinton. In what ways is this division playing out here in California and in the Central Valley, which of course remains one of the more conservative parts of California?
Yeah, well, you see a bit of a microcosm in the Central Valley of California, where you see Republicans who have really banded together in a much more intense way. You've seen Democrats really come out more publicly, grow their base, a lot more energy and intensity as well. I think when you drive around, it's the first time I've seen so many signs on both sides. And so you can feel that. You can feel it in conversations that you're in. There's just a lot more talk as well about politics, period. And so while there might have been divisions in the Central Valley before, it's much more a topic of discussion and certainly surfacing in ways that I know I've never been a part of having grown up in the Central Valley.
Clint, do you want to weigh in on this?
Well, in where I come from is a nonpartisan elected official, and I served at the very beginning. The end of my term on Fresno City Council was the beginning of the president's term in Washington, D.C. And, you know, we saw back then some of the same issues about the president's temperament. And I was able to laugh and joke with my colleagues on the city council and my neighbors and constituents at that time. So I didn't really feel polarization. Maybe it's a little bit different now where I'm at in business now. You know, the most important thing about business is trying to find a way around red tape and trying to get politicians to cut red tape. And so that's really what the conversation is. I think that in the business community, what matters most is making money and obviously providing for their families and running their businesses. And the feeling I get is the business community is pretty solid that they can do that no matter who the president in Washington, D.C. is.
Jim Boren, you are working every day to tackle these issues of media and public trust through your work at Fresno State. And I'm curious if you could talk to us about the extent that journalists and the media as a whole contribute to the divisive nature of our public life.
Well, in a perfect media world, the reporters and journalists reflect the community, and that reflects the entire community, all sides of it. And if there's a divisive conversation, they need to cover that. But they don't need to highlight the negatives sometimes the way that it's done. I think, for example, we could probably look at certain kinds of stories that get a lot of ink and airtime that are divisive. And if you go back and look at them, and I've looked at a few of them over the last several months, is that they're all almost always the same kind of news story. So as I tell my students at Fresno State in my advanced reporting class, is journalism offers value to a subject. So if the news reporters are not offering value to that subject, moving the story forward, analyzing it, giving them all the information, reporting all sides of it, then they tend to spin their wheels. And sometimes we get off on this divisive track of certain things and spend a lot of time on that when we could spend more time in explaining the election process, explaining why it takes so long to count mail-in ballots, explaining the Electoral College in great depth and why we have that. Because you see that on Facebook and you look at other kinds of information from the general public, and they're asking here at election time all those questions. Now, they were answered in a lot of ways in a lot of forums, but we need to really focus on educating the public about the process and reflecting all sides of the public's point of view.
And I have to ask you one more question on this topic. Do you think that the media has overreported polling leading up to elections? And what do we do? What do we do with polls following 2020?
I don't think they've overreported it. I think in some cases they've just misreported it. I think that, for example, they don't really explain the margin of error. They don't explain that, you know, the polls were relatively close in 2016. In fact, in a lot of cases, they're on the mark if you got the margin of error. But I think the media and a lot of folks built this expectation that if Donald Trump won, it would be this overwhelming surprise. And if you looked at the numbers, especially in the swing states, and you started calculating the electoral votes, you knew it was going to be relatively close if everything fell the way that it did. I know that Amanda Renteria could speak more closely to this because she was there that night. She was the political director. She's counting votes. She understood that. But I think that there was a narrative out there that Secretary Clinton was going to win pretty handily. Then we're seeing that again in this current election, where there was a narrative that former Vice President Biden was going to win relatively easily. And we, as of this tape, and we don't know the result, but whoever wins, it's going to be very close.
Amanda Renteria, do you want to weigh in on this issue of polling leading up to the election?
Sure. There's a couple of things that I want to surface here. One is, I do think that the polling industry needs to take a step back, relook at the way it actually polls, how polls are used. Certainly on a campaign, you see exactly what's missing in the polls. And of course, on a campaign, you're trying to drive a certain narrative. What I will say that's really interesting over the last 4 years till now, and even as we think about votes being counted right now, you know, Jim is right about there's been a long track record of journalists needing to educate the public about how the process works. Because that hasn't been done, we are now seeing that campaigns or somebody like Trump can actually make up stories about how the system works. Like right now, a lot of this counting is, he's certainly calling it illegal. Counting after votes have been in, that's not illegal, that's counting. And I think that's the part that's been really different in this election cycle, honestly putting a lot more pressure on journalists to not only have to report what's happening, but truly educate the public while campaigns, particularly in this case, Trump, trying to define what the process actually is, because people haven't been educated about it. And so as I look at it, you know, that's a big piece for, you know, everyone that's looking at this, looking at being a journalist. Part of the problem is there isn't a real foundational education around civics.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're talking to Jim Boren, Executive Director of the Institute for Media and Public Trust at Fresno State, Amanda Renteria, CEO of Code for America, and Clint Olivier, former Fresno City Council member and Executive Director of the Business Federation of the Central Valley. So I'd like to shift our conversation and talk about what happened in California on Tuesday. There were, of course, a number of key initiatives on the ballot, along with several congressional races, including that contentious face-off between TJ Cox and David Valadao to represent the 21st Congressional District. So I'd like to just go around and get a temperature check from each of you. And Clint, I'm going to go ahead and start with you. So as you reflect on this election and how votes came down in the state, and particularly here in the Central Valley, what jumps out to you, or what did you find significant or surprising?
You mentioned the Congressman T.J. Cox versus former Congressman David Valadao race, and nowhere in is it encapsulated better in the Central Valley than the whole idea of a Valleycrat. I can tell you from my associations in politics and in business and in journalism as well that some members, no matter which party they're from, are just accepted as, hey, that's our guy. And an example of that is Jim Costa, who has fended off so many challenges from Republicans and even within his own party, because I think the electorate in the Central Valley here sees Jim Costa as our guy. I don't really think that he's viewed as a hyper partisan figure. I think he's just seen as our representative in Washington. And with the Valadao seat, or Cox seat, or whichever way you want to see it, because they're still tabulating those results. That's a Valleycrat seat. You know, that's the sometimes it's a Republican and sometimes it's a Democrat, and it might flip back this year. You know, in the year that was supposed to be so heavily anti-Trump, the Republican might win that seat back. So I think it's different, and I know that Amanda can speak to this more articulately than I can. But in the Valley, it's different. We have our representatives. We have our and I think people cross partisan lines to vote for those people.
Amanda, you know, you ran against Valadao in 2014. What are your thoughts about what's happening in that district?
Yeah, so you're seeing all across the country high voter turnout in rural areas. And I think Trump has done a really good job at bringing people involved, engaging people in the process, bringing out Republican voters, rural voters, and is doing well there. I think we are also having a moment where in 2018, there was a huge swath of younger communities of color really start to engage in politics, too. But I actually don't disagree with what Clint said when people say, hey, that's your guy. Literally to the point, that's your guy. We still haven't elected enough women in the Central Valley. But the reason why I mention that is because I do think the Central Valley is beginning to change. The race in TJ Cox winning, Fresno County bringing in new voices, Latino voices starting to run. You're seeing younger women winning and running at those school board levels and college levels. And so I think there is a change that is happening, and there's always going to be, are you from here? That piece of it is always and will be true. And there's a pride when you are from there. I certainly know I have it. But, you know, what leadership looked like and what leadership is, I think we are beginning to change that, where people are beginning to welcome new voices. And so we're going to see in this race whether it bounces back and forth. But the reason why you're seeing that bounce is because there's a new rising voice, new America, really beginning to say, I too belong at that leadership table.
Jim Boren, anything this election that surprised you or jumped out at you?
Well, you know, a lot of things tend to surprise me. One thing that jumps out at me immediately is that the conservative San Joaquin Valley is starting to change a bit. Fresno County, for example, in 2016 was won handily by Secretary Clinton over Donald Trump. So she carried Fresno County. The rest of the counties, Trump carried pretty easily. In this election, and the counting's not over, but former Vice President Biden has 53% of the vote right now to President Trump's 44% in Fresno County. And, you know, this wouldn't have happened 15 or 20 years ago. Fresno County was pretty reliably going for the Republican. And as the demographics of the Valley changes and more people get involved in the process, you're going to see those changes. And I think that the future is going to be much more purple in the San Joaquin Valley, and maybe getting a little more blue in some counties that might surprise us as people get registered and the demographics change. So that was an interesting one. And then we have essentially a replay in the Valadao T.J. Cox race of 2 years ago, where Valadao has a pretty handy lead. But as more and more votes came in, especially from Kern County, T.J. Cox moved ahead. So that's going to be an interesting one to watch. The Valley is always an interesting place to look, because I think that, many parts of California are very predictable. The Valley tends not to be. But surprisingly, and maybe not so surprisingly, is that the Democrats in Fresno County looks more like the state of California and not like the rest of the San Joaquin Valley.
Amanda Renteria, I'd like to come back to you. Let's talk about some of the results of the propositions. I'm particularly interested in Proposition 15, which the PPIC has been tracking this through polls. We predicted that it would probably be a tight race. Precincts are still reporting, so we don't know at this point what direction it's going to go. But it appears as if voters have rejected Prop 15. Did that come as a surprise to you?
It does. It actually, the idea that California is liberal, right, often gets pegged as one of the bluest states in the union. And when you look through the proposition, it actually is quite moderate. Everything that happened seems to have really fallen into more moderate, even conservative votes. It did surprise me. I also understand how the process works and how confusing it could be. I also do wonder whether, just in general, people thinking about the top of the ticket and saying, "Okay, I'm gonna show my, left leaning here and my right leaning there." This is a complex community, and I think new people engaging in this process is really going to add a different demographic shift, not just in who runs, but also how these ballot measures line up. And so I think there's going to be a lot of folks taking a look at what happened in this election cycle on these ballot measures, and what they're going to see is that it's quite moderate relative to the reputation that California has.
And I should have mentioned before, Prop 15 would have raised the assessment for property taxes for many commercial businesses. Clint Olivier, given your work with the Business Federation of the Central Valley, are you surprised by 15 not passing potentially, or are you just relieved?
Well, I'm actually pleasantly surprised. My organization, the board of directors, actually took a position of no on Prop 15. And I agree with Amanda that, we get a bad rap out here in California because people think, hey, this is a bastion of progressivism. But Prop 13, of course, two generations ago, it's sacred, I think, to Californians, and it's important to Californians across the political spectrum. And so, I'm pleasantly surprised that it failed this year, or it looks like it's going to fail this year, because, speaking from the business perspective, it would have caused, obviously landlords are not going to just eat that. They're going to pass it along to their tenants, and those folks are going to pass it on to the final consumer. So really, in my mind, it's a regressive tax on working families. And so, folks just said, no, we're going to go ahead and stick with our Prop 13 protections this year. And it surprises me, but it doesn't.
I also just think that right now people are worried about jobs and economics. And it was a way to actually weigh in on that conversation. And so, there's a lot of conversation about the divisiveness, but there's a lot of folks who are unemployed right now. And so perhaps seeing the business community come out for something, maybe folks were a little bit more understanding and wanted to really think about jobs as we come out of this pandemic and economic crisis.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Jim Boren, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. So I also think, and I really appreciate the points that both Amanda and Clint made on this, because they were very good. Another factor is that, as Clint pointed out, Prop 13 was this sacred trust after property taxes were literally driving people out of their homes because they were going up so fast in California. And I think that there is still a large number of voters, especially, you know, the baby boomer folks that have now retired, that it's a matter of trust. That they don't believe that if you get your, you know, the camel gets a nose in the tent on the commercial side of Prop 13, the next time they're coming after residential. And I think that's something that is that people worry about, because, you know, those of who are fortunate enough to be able to have a home and then worry about being able to keep it, that's always in the back of the mind. So there's a lot of factors in this, and it would have it would surprise me if it would have passed.
Well, I want to thank all of you for helping us unpack what happened on Tuesday. Jim Boren, Executive Director of the Institute for Media and Public Trust at Fresno State, Amanda Renteria, CEO of Code for America, and Clint Olivier, former Fresno City Council member and Executive Director of the Business Federation of the Central Valley. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As the nation looks to its future following the 2020 election, we turn to history to better understand how our state was shaped by two significant leaders, former governors Pat Brown and his son Jerry Brown. Earlier this week, I spoke with Miriam Powell, author of The Browns of California, the family dynasty that transformed a state and helped shape a nation. On Thursday, she will speak at a CSU Bakersfield public history event about the impact these governors had on the criminal justice system. We talked about the upcoming event and her thoughts on the election. Given the extensive research that you've conducted about California's history, I'd like to start by hearing your thoughts about the 2020 election and how it could potentially shape the future of the state of California.
It's very interesting trying to make sense of what are in some ways some extremely progressive positions that California voters took, as they often have in the past, and then some much less so, and particularly in the propositions where we saw a lot of the causes that labor and that progressives had pushed going down to defeat. And I'm looking at this and seeing that I think that fear was a really big motivation this year. In the sense that people, particularly people who had a lot of money, and Prop 22, which was the Uber and Lyft prop, is probably the best example of that, where there was a record spending of $200 million, but also Prop 15, which is the tax proposal, and we still don't quite know where that's ending up, but it looks like it's not going to pass. So that these appeals to people that play to their fears, which is always true in elections. So the fear that you're going to have to pay more in taxes, the fear that this is a first step towards repealing Prop 13, the fear that Uber and Lyft are going to disappear if this proposition passes. I think we saw a lot of that. And again, those are always common in elections, but I think it resonated really deeply in a time when we are, as a state, you know, struggling so much with the pandemic and with all of the economic consequences of it, and high unemployment and real economic concerns and worries on people's part.
So we're talking now in advance of an event hosted by CSU Bakersfield, where you will be speaking about the legacies of Governors Pat Brown and Jerry Brown, and particularly about the impact that they had on the criminal justice system. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of a preview of what you're going to talk about.
Sure. And I think I'll segue right out of last night's results, because the one area that I didn't mention just now was criminal justice, where there was a very strong vote against Proposition 20, which was a measure put on the ballot by law enforcement that would have rolled back a lot of the criminal justice reforms that were enacted by the legislature and by popular vote under the last two terms of Governor Jerry Brown. The former governor spent some of his hard-saved money to fight Prop 20 and was successful. And we also saw the success of Prop 17, which would give felons the right to vote. So we saw on criminal justice a real continuation of a swing in the state that was, I would say, encouraged by and helped along by Governor Brown in the last two of his historic four terms. And that was a shift in a real view of the criminal justice system that is consistent with a national trend, but I think California is really leading on this in the sense of redefining even the nature of punishment, the nature of the prison system, and that the point is not just punishment, but rehabilitation. I will read the Jerry Brown tweeted after the results that in voting down Prop 20, California voters signaled once again that they believe most human beings can turn their lives around if given the chance. And I think that sentiment of the belief in the power of redemption and the importance of hope is very significant and really an important piece of his legacy in the last few terms. As governor, he granted more pardons and commutations than anyone else, or probably most governors put together in modern times. That's an evolution for him from, you know, as you know, he was governor the first time around in from 1975 to 1982, and had quite a different stance on criminal justice then, also more in keeping with the times. It was the beginning of the onset of the buildup of the criminal justice system and the mass incarceration that we are now retreating from. So I guess I've answered your question a little bit in reverse order, but one of the themes of my book, which looks at the impact of the four generations of Browns, but particularly Pat Brown and Jerry Brown, their impact on the criminal justice system is really profound. Pat Brown as well, in terms of both his support of criminal justice policies and his going back to his early years as San Francisco District Attorney, which was the first office he won, in which he was in some ways a prototype, an early progressive prosecutor who defined his job as helping especially the youth of San Francisco to stay out of trouble. So he was a little bit ahead of his time on that. And then as attorney general, and then as governor for 8 years. So between the two of them, I mean, they have governed the state for 24 years, and each of them was attorney general as well. So there's quite an enormous impact on the criminal justice system as a whole. And the one other piece that I wanted to just throw out there is their impact on the courts, because each of them appointed a lot of judges, Jerry Brown in particular. I think he has said that he appointed more than 1,000 judges. Each of them had a very strong impact on shaping the California Supreme Court. And Jerry Brown getting to do that twice in very different ways, the second time than the first time. And in particular, Jerry Brown's vision of the need for the bench to reflect all of California was something that I think we kind of take for granted today in a lot of ways. But when he brought that with him into the governor's office the first time in 1975 and began to appoint, for example, defense attorneys, which was pretty unheard of at that time, that was really changed. It was the beginning of a real change and a sort of revolution in how we think about the courts and the bench. And he appointed the first woman, the first African-American, and the first Latino to the California Supreme Court, and then continued in all of his four terms, really, to appoint a very sort of interesting mix of judges that was a break from the past.
Definitely ahead of his time in that regard.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Proposition 20 earlier. I'd like to talk about another proposition that was on the ballot that was also connected to Jerry Brown, and that's Prop 25, which would have put into effect a law that Governor Brown signed back in 2018 to abolish the cash bail system. Mm-hmm. Voters, it appears, have rejected that proposition. So the cash bail system remains intact. Thinking about Brown's legacy, how significant was this defeat?
I think it's a real setback for the efforts to change the bail system and to eliminate cash bail, because I think it's unlikely that the legislature is going to take this up again anytime soon, given what we saw, which was essentially the bail bond industry's ability to force a vote that overturned it. There's an odd, very strange bedfellows in the opposition to Prop 25, because the original law that Governor Brown signed was very much a compromise. And it was a compromise because that was what the key players thought that they could, was as much as they could get through. But a lot of the more liberal and progressive groups that had supported the effort to eliminate cash bail were opposed to the law that finally passed, because they felt it gave too much discretion to judges, and there were issues with it where they did not feel it went far enough. So those groups, they opposed Prop 25 because their feeling is that it was a bad law and that it's more important to defeat the bad law and to come back and try to get a better law the next time. Maybe that strategy works, but it seems rather unlikely that they're going to get through a more liberal version of that. So I think that's a setback for the efforts to eliminate cash bail. Although, you know, to some extent, some of it is going on anyway in a lot of parts of the state because of the pandemic, where the Judicial Council mandated no bail release for certain crimes early on during the crisis, and many counties have continued that. So I think we will continue to see efforts to change the bail system. I also think it's another example, which is not uncommon in California, where sometimes propositions are so confusing that it's very hard for people to know what they're voting on. And we had a lot of that this year.
Certainly did.
Sometimes they're deliberately misleading. But I mean, again, in this case, I mean, I just had to think it through again to say that you had to vote yes on Prop 25 in order to be in favor of eliminating cash bail.
right?
So I think that, there was just a lot of confusion. And again, a part of the community that one would have expected to turn out to support that was actually actively lobbying against it. So you had the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party in some ways in alliance with the bail bond industry to defeat this, and that did it. So I don't think we've seen the end of that issue, but it may be a while before it comes back on the state level for sure.
Well, Miriam Powell, author of The Browns of California, The Family Dynasty That Transformed a State and Helped Shape a Nation, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You guys are one of my favorite public radio stations.
We appreciate it. Thank you. You're listening to Valley Edition. Nearly 8 months in, the COVID-19 pandemic is looking grim. The virus has killed more than 230,000 Americans. And this week, for the first time, more than 100,000 cases were reported in a single day. Although California has so far avoided a fall surge, we wanted to know, is it only a matter of time before it reaches us? And what happens if it does? FM89's Carrie Klein spoke about the possibility of a second surge with two local hospital systems as part of this week's COVID-19 update. Welcome back, Carrie.
Thanks, Kathleen.
So as usual, let's start with a snapshot of COVID-19 in the Valley, looking at the last week.
Okay, so, honestly, things are still looking pretty much the same as they have been. Cases do appear to be inching back up, but slowly, and it hasn't been enough to push any counties out of their reopening tier just yet. Fatalities are staying relatively steady. Around 30 people are dying every week. That still is a lot, but that number has not been increasing significantly at all anytime recently. Then when we look at hospitals, hospital beds and ICU beds, those numbers are kind of bouncing around a lot from day to day. But again, they're not really changing all that appreciably either. So that's all, at least not bad news. And then when we look at the Blueprint for a Safer Economy, the statewide reopening plan, all the counties in our area stayed in their reopening tier this week. There have been no changes, and there will be no imminent changes for at least another couple of weeks, because there's always a grace period before that happens. And so right now, Madera and Tulare counties are both in purple, the most restrictive tier, that is. Kern, Kings, Merced, and Fresno counties are all in red, the next tier up. And then Mariposa County is in the yellow, least restrictive tier.
So it is a little scary to see surges happening right now in the middle of the country. You said that here in the Valley, daily cases are inching back up. Is there any indication that that is the start of a surge?
I don't think that anyone is in a position to speculate anything like that just yet. In fact, you know, county health officials have been taking a bit of a break from their normal public events. And in Fresno and Kern counties specifically, you know, they've had fewer press briefings in the past few weeks because things aren't really changing all that much. On the other hand, county health officials have been warning that if we don't keep our guard up against this virus, our local case rates will follow what's been happening around the country.
One place where we know a surge would be the most obvious is a hospital. What are local hospitals saying about COVID cases?
Well, the good news is that we've been seeing, you know, COVID patient loads in hospitals stay relatively steady valley-wide for the last couple of weeks. But, you know, I spoke with officials with two hospital systems who say they're keeping a very close eye on the numbers. And frankly, they are expecting them to rise once again. Here's Terry Bogus. She's the Director of Infection Prevention for Adventist Health Central Valley, which has four hospitals in Fresno, Kings, and Tulare counties.
Yes, we are anticipating a surge. We're not sure if it will mimic what we experienced in the summer or not. The nation is experiencing larger surges in those areas that did not have a large surge in the summer. So it'll be interesting to see where we fall in there. But we are definitely looking at our numbers every day and making sure that we're ready should this happen again.
Okay, but what will being ready mean?
Well, Bogus says that, you know, they have this arsenal of strategies to use that worked during the first surge over the summer. And so for them and a lot of hospitals that I've spoken to throughout the pandemic, you know, that involved changing how space inside the hospital was used. For instance, in Adventist Hanford, they were able to designate one entire ICU floor as COVID only, and they were able to isolate some other hallways for only COVID patients. They're also ready to shuffle patients between hospitals. So of Adventist's four hospitals here in the Valley, you know, the one in Hanford took the majority of the COVID patients over the summer. And so sometimes their non-COVID patients would be moved to Selma or Reedley or Tulare to get care there. And then there's Valley Children's, which has at times taken pediatric patients from Adventist and other local hospitals in order to give those hospitals space for COVID patients. So these hospitals feel that, you know, they've already been through this once and they can jump back into some of these protocols quickly if need be.
So that's how these hospitals are making space for patients. But what about staffing levels? I understand that one of the limiting factors over the summer was having the staff necessary for all the beds that hospitals have.
Yeah, that's correct. And there were some temporary solutions to that, too. For instance, if you remember, we talked about this in an earlier show over the summer, the Department of Defense sent in a handful of teams of military doctors, doctors and nurses, to various hospitals in the area. And one of those came to Adventist Health Hanford. Here's Terry Bogus again.
They were a godsend, and we were very thankful for the help that they provided. They sent providers, nurses, respiratory therapists, and they came at a very pivotal time for us.
Now, there's no guarantee that the military would send these doctors again, but Bogus told me Adventist would take them if they were offered. And so did Thomas Utek. He is chief medical officer for community medical centers in Fresno. He also said that they'd be ready to take on traveling nurses. There are these nurses who get assignments around the country through contracting companies. Utek said these nurses are a great resource, and not just because they can staff more hospital beds.
Our own staff, unfortunately, are becoming sick as well. So we certainly are doing all we can to decrease folks within our own staff from becoming ill, but it's not going to be zero, so we may have to use those other resources.
We're also entering flu season now, and many health officials, in fact, refer to the winter as having a potential for a twindemic of flu and COVID-19. What are you hearing about that?
Well, both Baucus and UTEC told me they're optimistic that flu season won't actually be as severe as it has been in years past, which is exactly what happened in a lot of the Southern Hemisphere, which just got out of flu season. And that's likely because of all of the precautions that people are taking now. You know, we're distancing, we're keeping away from each other, we're wearing masks, there's hand hygiene. All of those things also prevent the spread of the flu. However, doctors are very much aware that co-infections of the flu and other respiratory illnesses are predictors of more severe COVID-19. So they are bracing for some kind of increase in respiratory patients nonetheless.
So all in all, should there be a second surge, are these hospitals feeling prepared?
Yeah, when it comes to Adventist and community medical centers, both of them say they are feeling prepared. You know, and I should note, though, that hospitals don't work in a vacuum, particularly during this pandemic. They've had to get pretty creative about working with each other and with health officials. And so the state has established a whole number of overflow sites for COVID patients. You know, Fresno County health officials have told me that one site in Porterville, which was used for dozens of patients over the summer, it's not in use now, but it could be opened back up at a moment's notice. Beds are also lying in wait at various fairgrounds and the Fresno Convention Center, which was actually mobilized to take on survivors of the Creek Fire that were airlifted out of, you know, Mammoth Pool Reservoir. And then Thomas UTEC did tell me that if there is a silver lining anywhere in this pandemic, it's how well hospitals from various networks have been working together. They've been pooling their resources to share patients and build bed capacity.
You know, I mean, we certainly, I think there is collaboration between the region's hospitals, but the collaboration is at a whole different level now.
Well, Carrie, this is great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. And now it's time for another StoryCorps San Joaquin. As part of our collaboration with the Personal History Project, we'll be airing segments over the next year based on recorded conversations from February 2020's mobile tour in Fresno and Bakersfield. Today you'll hear from two sisters, Diane Flowers and Marilyn Harris. They share stories about their beloved father, a man dedicated to peace and practicing what you preach. Diane starts the conversation.
So I'd like to talk about Dad, Marion Sanders. He was a great dad. I had a wonderful time growing up with him, had some very fond memories. And I just wanted to kind of commemorate his being with us in life. He's been gone since 2017, but I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't miss him. I didn't know how close I was to Dad.
Yeah. I was very close to Dad. No matter where I was in the United States, my dad would give me a call.
I miss, and I didn't, it used to annoy me, but I understand now what he was talking about. Call me when you get home. Call me when you get home. Call you when I get home. Why? It's a part of being a parent and worrying and making sure you're okay. Having seven children, that's a lot to worry about.
Yeah.
For a long time.
I am the third oldest.
I am the youngest. That's the best spot.
Yeah, that's what we...
And he used to always tell the story, I was past 40 and I thought it was all over. And here comes Diane. Mm-hmm. Yeah, here I come.
Going back to some of that history that he went through by refusing to go to the military because he felt like he didn't want to carry any weapons.
Right.
And he had to pay the cost for making that decision.
Right. It was kind of interesting to learn that they sent him to prison and he went to prison because he wouldn't go to the Korean War. He lived out that life. He was all about peace. Mm-hmm. He was all about being a child of God and, you know, being a minister, practicing what you preach. He did that.
Dad was very good with phone numbers, and he didn't mind picking up the phone, calling calling people.
So I felt like a telephone operator a lot of times because it didn't matter day or night. If you're a pastor and people need you, they call you.
Yeah.
And he would get up and go.
People didn't believe that Dad disciplined us.
I hardly ever got disciplined.
I know you did, but I know I did. You know, his words was, if I don't get you, God gonna get me.
Right.
So
he believed all of it. A child left to his own
will bring his mother to shame. Open shame.
Yeah.
And he didn't believe in that.
So that was in there too. So I have to follow the scriptures. Wow.
When we would get in trouble and be stubborn, he would say, sit down. Let's read a little bit. Mm-hmm. And take us to the Bible and read and explain to us. And at least for me, that pricked my heart.
I remember being afraid at night. When I was afraid, wouldn't like to sleep in my room at night. The scripture I got was, God has not given us the spirit of fear. And that was to settle my mind and understand whatever it is, you can handle it. He quoted the scriptures like people quote Shakespeare. The Bible was his Shakespeare. It was really hard to watch the transition of Dad being that person to Dad being the person with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. He used to always say, I'm the most independent person you'll ever meet.
Right.
Until he wasn't. We didn't understand that transition at first. He kept repeating himself. He kept taking a long time to remember where he's going. We didn't know that's what was going on with his mind.
Right.
And it was terrible, horrible experience to watch him decline.
But you know what, Diane? Daddy gonna do what Daddy wanna do. He was very independent, and I'ma leave when I get ready to leave. Mm-hmm. And guess what?
He did.
He left on a Sunday morning. Y'all go to church, I'll be all right. And time we got back from church, Daddy was gone. And it hurt, but I laughed. I said, you got us again. You didn't do what you wanted to do and how you wanted to do it.
In my mind, I pictured him taking his hat and his coat and leaving without anybody noticing.
He made a big impact
on people. And Reverend Sanders. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. That name, that recognition opened a lot of doors. That was years and years of goodwill to people.
Yeah. That was one of a kind.
It's been wonderful to remember the experiences, the laughter, the joy, the fun times, even the hard times, and remembering his strength, his will, his character, his being.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Laura Satsui, who is leaving us this week for her new job at WESA in Pittsburgh. Good luck, Laura. We'll miss you. Technical support is from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in Californians' decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.